Some said the dawn of online journalism would bring us more voices and a level playing field, and yet we're left with ever more white noise. But what if you could merge the global reach and international perspectives of an online publication with the good old-fashioned tangible appeal of paper? We'll talk to one man who's done exactly that today on The Stack. Coming up today, from El Salvador to Moldova, we'll look at how Positive Magazine sources its international ideas.
We select directly the contents by ourselves. And that's, I think, what the people also like. You know, I buy something because I know I'm going to find something very interesting.
Plus, ever considered starting a magazine? We'll talk to a woman who has quite literally written the book on it.
So you can, you know, spend a year crafting a beautiful object and galvanising a bit of an audience, but then you have to be able to deliver issue 2, issue 3, issue 4.
All that plus a trip to the newsstands of Paris. That's today on The Stack. News and views from the print industry here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now, if you wanted to get your hands on a copy of Positive Magazine last year, you might have had some trouble. Back then, it was little more than a PDF document consumed via your screen. Today, however, it's a lush print publication on shelves every 6 months, and we've just unwrapped a fresh copy of issue number 2. Here it is. Robust. Giacomo Cosua is the founder and editor-in-chief, and he joins us here today. Congratulations, Giacomo. Yeah. Always exciting. Second issue on newsstands. Tell us a little bit about the experience. How's it been getting issue number 2 onto newsstands? Just a joy from start to finish, or a few struggles along the way?
Yeah, first of all, just thanks for having me here.
Very
it's
welcome.
A pleasure. And every time we publish something new, it's like having a new baby coming out, and and the feeling of just having it on hands and, you know, touching the paper, I think it's a great pleasure. And that's what we have been looking forward for a long time.
A long time, yeah.
And as we started first just online, and then we have tried like very hard to, you know, to accomplish our goal that was also be like, we believe it's still in printing. So
well, let me ask you a bit more about that. I'm sure this is a question you've been asked a million times, but we were used in the publishing world to seeing established print titles going digital, having to find an online presence. And obviously your experience is exactly the opposite. Was it just your love for paper, for the feel of the tactility of print and that kind of thing? Why did it make so much sense to follow that reverse course, if you like, and go onto print from an online presence?
First of all, it was like online, we could just, you know, start something. There was like at the beginning, so it was 9 years ago when we started. We didn't have like a proper idea, and, you know, it was kind of, you know, like a hobby with friends. We started up, and then it becomes like something more serious. But I think it was a good time to get the experience, the knowledge about what is publishing and what we should speak about and so on. And I think also when you start, you know, like printing is as this problem is like expensive to print. So you have to find out, you know, sponsors and so on to get it out. So I think it was like a process, but it was clear from the first moment that one day we will get the print one. And this online process was very helpful to understand much more about the business. And now here we are.
And that's interesting on that point, because when we have editors on, I often ask them about this. You're a photographer, but our readers of Monocle will probably have seen your work in the pages of our magazine. And now you're are you a publisher? I mean, you're an editor, the founder of the thing. Do you think that editors these days need to be commercially savvy, or can you just bring your creative talents, your photographer's eyes to it? Is it necessary to think in those commercial terms as well?
Well, I think a bit, yeah. It's not like a must, but something that you have to calculate to keep on working. I think, you know, like, I was being like crisis and so on, changed it a lot. And also you have to change the way you approach a new business. Mm. And yeah, and like commercial as in our magazine is not like the like prevalent. So we don't have much advertising, but we just want, you know, the advertising is also like a way to get the project done, obviously. But like the readers, when they will get the magazine, they can see there is not much, because we try to have like an idea together with our sponsor. It's not just having an advertising page, but we like share a project together and we work
so
on
that.
It's
a proper relationship.
Yes, totally.
It has real meaning for you. Now, I'm sort of leafing through, and a handsome volume it is, though I did mention briefly before the show began, you have got a West Ham feature, which as a Tottenham fan, it's a bit difficult to.
Yeah.
I'll just skip that. I'll skip those pages.
Yeah, totally.
But tell me, there's obviously, as we might expect, lots of very rich imagery, wonderful, lush shoots. How would you describe someone who's not familiar with it? What's the magazine about? Is it about photography first? Is it about reportage? What's the kind of? What is Positive about? I guess.
Well, starting from the title, like Positive is connected about photography, like the positive and negative, you know, on photography. So that's what we started. And also, like, the idea was like speaking about positive things somehow, but not just about that. But yeah, so the first goal for us was trying to find out beautiful images. So we do a lot of research. And the other big thing is like the quality. We really like try to get the best as our resources can give us. And yeah, so we started from photography, and then I mean, I love like reportage. So I just, you know, I put the things I think they are important to speak about, you know. And our like subtitle is Different Views Around the World. So it's not just about one country or one situation. Like, let's look around.
Broad.
Yeah.
And I suppose we should stress that there's clearly a tone of optimism and positivity in the magazine, but that doesn't mean that you shy away from some more challenging subject matter. And there's some pretty compelling reportage that certainly doesn't shy away from depicting some quite challenging scenes, so people should understand that they're getting the full range.
Yeah, I mean, if you speak about like the cover story of this issue, it's about like the drug cartels in El Salvador, and obviously it's not something, you know, it's something tough.
Not generally that positive of
a picture.
Yeah.
But still, like, it was an idea to, you know, to put it out.
Now, Giacomo, just tell me a little bit more about the evolution, because it always strikes me as interesting in the kind of relatively early days, certainly of the print edition, in the first kind of year or so. What's the pace of change like? Is it about you and your colleagues learning how to work differently each time, sharing ideas, saying, hey, do you know what we could do next is this? What's that process like? Or is there not really a plan? Is it quite ad hoc? You know, you kind of deal with challenges as they come up. How do you and your team work?
Yeah, we work in this way. So I'm more taking care of the contents. And my other mates that we do the project together are the art directors. So they are graphic designers. So usually we think about, like, I look around, you know, subject that I think they're important that we want to put in the magazine. And some other articles are proposed by, we have some contributors, especially for architecture. We have all the guys working architecture, they are architects graduated. So it's important for us, you know, like, it's not something random. Also, design speaking, we have someone is graduating in design. So from that point of view, we receive, you know, ideas, and then all together we sit on a table and they say, okay, look, what's next? And this is a good article, okay. And then we start working on a layout and deciding how much pages should we put for these things. Is important? No, like, this is more relevant, and so on. So we work a bit in Venice, and one mate of us is working in Berlin. So we do, you know, sometimes these Skype calls.
Nice.
And,
that's always
so
good.
On.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A true international production sort of schedule. That's Giacomo Cosio, founder and editor-in-chief of Positive. We'll have more from him a little later here on The Stack. Now, for those of you who thought about publishing your own magazine, we have the perfect book. So You Want to Publish a Magazine by Angharad Lewis goes through the step-by-step process of making a magazine, including the trickier, maybe less well-known facts like how to find the perfect distributor. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Angharad Lewis.
Angharad, it's a pleasure to have you here on The Stack, and you wrote a book that is perfect for our show. So you want to publish a magazine? That's a very good question. And my first question actually is, you know, is about when you thought about writing this book. It must be a bit hard because, you know, it's an industry that's moving very fast. People are breaking the rules all the time. So how come came the concept of the book?
Yeah, I think it is quite, there are difficulties involved in reflecting this very fast-moving, shifting landscape of new magazines in a book, because by its nature, a book is kind of one moment in time and it's a slower production. But, you know, as you know, there's a new magazine on the shelves every week in independent bookshops. So while I could have gone on interviewing magazines endlessly, I think I had to just sort of draw a line under it. And my real motivation with the book was to bring together the knowledge of lots of people that are making magazines already. So in a way, the, you know, if it's not the most current issues of magazines that we're that are featured in the book, hopefully it doesn't matter because the knowledge remains the same.
The idea is there, right? And I just want to ask you about, you mentioned about there's a new magazine every week coming out in the newsstands. And why do you think there's such a boom in independent magazines? Especially because, you know, just a few years ago, you know, this discourse of the end of print was everywhere. But I don't think this kind of talk is that strong now, I would say.
Yeah, I think that argument has been shelved, really, the idea of the death of print, as is proved by all these new magazines. But I think perhaps the boom in small niche independent magazines is the way that publishing has also become a kind of practice within other creative disciplines, and the people making magazines are incorporating this idea of publishing something into other things they do, like design or art or fashion. So it's becoming something within creative practice, this urge to publish and put something out there. And it's a lot freer now as well. I think one of the things that came across in making the book was that you can kind of design your own way of publishing. You don't have to be restricted by the traditional publishing models and routes to market and that sort of thing. People are really inventing their own way of publishing. And that's why it's sort of a really interesting new kind of creative field, I think.
I want to ask you as well, I mean, who is doing right, I mean, in terms of publishing a successful magazine? I know you speak to a lot of very interesting editors, designers of magazines that even, you know, we had on the stack before. I mean, could you give us perhaps like an example of a magazine you think had a nice kind of strategy, may I say?
There's a massive range, really, in the spectrum of publishing projects out there. And the idea of sort of quantifying success is quite tricky because success for a really small run sort of bedroom project really might be very different from a bigger, more kind of commercially driven title. But I think one example I really like is Disenio, which I think is quite rare in the indie publishing world, is that it was launched sort of from the ground up with a very coherent plan by Joanna Agerman-Ross, the editor-in-chief and founder. And she's interviewed in the book, and she took several years to kind of plan her publishing model and find all the right partners and thought very carefully about exactly what she wanted her magazine to be. And I think whatever scale you're doing it on, that how the physical object and also the way you create your publishing model, how those two things sort of relate to your identity as a magazine maker, really, and doing something that's sort of comfortable for you in a way, you know. And also, you know, while, you know, saying something is comfortable perhaps sounds a little bit staid, but I think the other factor is to have this sort of energy, you know. The most successful titles really reflect the energy of their makers, I think.
What I also like about your book, I mean, it's very clear your step-by-step on how to make a magazine. And even from, you know, so far, I don't have my own magazine. I work for one that it was actually featured on the book. For example, things that, you know, you never thought how to find a good distributor for your magazine as well. So was your intention to make it as clear as possible as well?
Yes. I mean, I wanted to tackle those thorny areas.
Yes,
like
exactly.
Distribution, advertising, funding, those things that are going on that are really important in the background of any magazine but often aren't spoken about. There's a really great kind of community of independent magazines, but, you know, often these difficult areas aren't spoken about so freely. So I sort of wanted to lift the lid on those processes and talk about the problems that are there for small magazine makers in things like distribution and advertising, and actually give some really practical advice and have people talk quite honestly about their experiences of the pitfalls in those areas as well.
I love those bits in the book. But also you mentioned, I believe, in the beginning of the book as well, what are the first things that you have to think about it if you really want to create your own magazine?
Oh, I think, yes, this is tricky because there is no sort of silver bullet, really. But I think one of the best pieces of advice to come out from the book is from Simon Esterson, one of the co-owners and creative director of I Magazine. He says, make something you're comfortable with. You need to be able to fulfill the promise that you make with the first issue of your magazine, so you can, you know, spend a year crafting a beautiful object and galvanising a bit of an audience, but then you have to be able to deliver issue 2, issue 3, issue 4. So I think be realistic, probably start small unless you've got a load of money behind you, which is rare, and plan, I guess, because if you start small, you know, you can evolve, and the process of evolution is really important to magazines. You know, you need to be constantly moving and refining what you're doing and pushing yourselves to the next step. So actually starting small is not a bad thing. It means you've got somewhere to build from.
Are there any lessons in the book that you can apply for more mainstream publications perhaps as well? Because, you know, we're talking about independent magazines, you know, that they're growing, as you said, there's new titles all the time, but, you know, the traditional press, I mean, they did suffer sometimes in terms of circulation, but do you think they have any lessons to learn as well?
Well, I think mainstream press is actually beginning to look to the independent sector for how they're doing things, actually, because there are so many failings now, or, you know, difficulties in mainstream press as well. So the indie sector is really where the innovation's happening, and I think there are, you know, things that independent magazines can do because they're so free that mainstream press can sort of copy a bit.
Well, thanks so much. I mean, very interesting things about your book. But I want to know about your personal experience with magazines as well, of course, before writing the book. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, I have been editor of Graphic since 2003. Well, actually, I joined Graphic in 2003 as staff writer, back in the days when it was quite a different magazine called Graphics International. It's currently an online-only magazine. But yeah, through the course of working with Graphic, we went through a big redesign and relaunch. We did a management buyout. We had a big mainstream publisher. Myself and the other editor, Caroline Roberts, we did a management buyout, and we ran Graphic independently for several years and went through lots of ups and downs through quite a difficult period in print publishing, and now publish online. And I've been involved in as a contributor to various different titles. So I have a bit of hands-on experience and a passion for magazines, which goes back to childhood. But I think I didn't really want to set myself up as a sort of oracle of, you know, the fount of all knowledge about magazines with this book. I sort of wanted to, almost as a fan of magazines, really bring together what other magazine makers know and have experienced making magazines. So, well, I have a bit of experience myself. Hopefully it's representing a lot of different magazine makers' experiences.
That was Angharad Lewis talking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Her book, So You Want to Publish a Magazine, including some tidbits from our own Tyler Brulé, is published by Lawrence King, and it's out on the 5th of August. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24, still with me, Giacomo Cosio, the founder and editor of Positive Magazine. Giacomo, we were talking a bit before about the, you know, the way that you and your colleagues work. Tell me a bit about your sort of broader creative inspirations. Obviously, you're a photographer too. Is it about, you know, looking at newsstands as you travel around the world? Do you see other magazines and think, wow, that's great, or I don't like that, or I would have done this? Or is it much more of a pure experience where you train your photographer's eye on things and just see, like, wow, this is the story I need to tell? Where do you get your inspiration from? Or is it from everywhere?
Yeah, well, a bit. I mean, I love magazines. I buy so much, like I don't have any space anymore at home. Like I try to.
You'd be surprised how many guests on this program have exactly this problem. Yeah.
So yeah, and when I started like working in Venice, I started to be like as journalist, and then we were doing a magazine in Venice, like locally. So that's how I get a bit more of my knowledge of publishing. Mm. And then I said, yeah, why not? I'm doing my own magazine, you know. And it was just online. It was like you didn't have to put much money to do that, and just how it started. And then yes, I look like magazines issues, what other people are doing, you know, looking always for new photographers, new editors, what we can speak about, and try obviously to find something different that has been not published yet.
And just on that, I wonder whether do you sort of have magazines that you always look out for? I mean, people will be like, oh well, I always look at you know Italian Vogue or whatever it might be. Are there things that you always kind of go back to? Or if you look at a great newsstand or a great news kiosk somewhere, do you just literally go with where your eye takes you and say, wow, what's this? I don't know this one.
Yeah, I think I buy like so many different, you know, I don't have one, you know, like, I mean, if I see a nice picture inside, I'm going to buy it and I'm going to check it out. Who is the photographer? So I think it's pretty wide, you know. I can buy, I don't know, from Financial Times, you know, the magazine to something else, to like a small one. And also it's always interesting to see new magazines coming out, you know, because there is, when I started, it was 2007, I think, there were not so many magazines as we have now. Yeah. And it's very interesting to see like how these publishing things, especially the independent way, develop.
Why do you think that is? Because obviously, yeah, as you say, it's been an extraordinary, well, nearly, what, 10 years, I guess, now. It's like the lifespan of Monocle magazine, in fact. Why is that? Do you just think it's because people are so passionate about print products, they're passionate about magazines, and they are willing to give it a go? Is it something broader in the marketplace? Is it because there are more pressures on big providers and publishers? Why do you think it's such a buoyant scene? Because certainly financially it's quite straitened times.
Well, I think that in one hand we have internet and we can find everything, and there is, it's complicated to do a selection of contents, you know. And when you buy something, when you do a magazine, you know, you have to put first like so much effort, you know, to think about layout and so on. And then, as you know, we like it costs a lot to produce a magazine. I think when you buy something, you think, okay, I'm going to find probably the best that I can, you know, I go for. That's, for example, the same for us. On the website, you know, we receive like every day so many submissions and so on. Obviously, we narrow what we find and we say, okay, this is good. But like for the magazine, we do, for the print version, we do another process. So we select directly like the contents by ourselves. So we do like research. It's not someone that is sent in to us and then we publish it. And that's, I think, what the people also like. You know, I buy something because I know I'm going to find something very interesting.
Yeah. Let's look maybe finally just a bit towards the future. And I know it's always a bit tricky with the biannual, because there's so much kind of planning. It's such a long process. How does it work looking ahead to, I don't know, issue 3 or even further ahead? What's that process like? Do you manage to just keep a bit of distance and try and look at things, you know, in a very detached way? Or have you and your colleagues got lots of great ideas? Maybe, well, I don't want to get you to reveal any secrets, exciting things that you're thinking about doing?
Well, at the moment now we are just taking a breath because just we released the new issue. But yeah, I think we start thinking about the new contents in September. So just after summer, we see around what's going on. And we look around if there are like some events we might be interested to cover. Usually we cover, like, as we are like Venice based, we cover the film festival, all the architecture, Art Biennale. So like we think, okay, in 6 months the magazine is still out till the new issue is coming. So for example, there is an event that is taking long time and we might speak about that. So we look around what's going on. But
so but still sometimes a blank canvas still really at the moment.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Very
totally,
exciting.
Yeah.
Giacomo, it's been great to have you with us. Thanks so much for telling us all about Positive Issue 2, Different Views Around the World. It's available on all good newsstands now, I think we should say. Wonderful. Giacomo, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, if you've ever wandered the streets of Paris hungry for your morning news fix, you'll likely have come across one of the city's distinctive newsstands. For generations, they stood at the centre of the Parisian news cycle, ensuring busy city folk were always in the know. But they might not be around for very much longer. Monocle's Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson, explains.
The bottle green newspaper kiosk has been a fixture on the streets of Paris since the middle of the 19th century. Today, there are around 400 of them, and for the most part, their shape, size and finish has hardly changed since the architect Gabriel Davioux came up with the original design. There's a sense of harmony between these iconic kiosks and the other Parisian street furniture, the benches, the lampposts, the fences and the balustrades. So it is not difficult to imagine the anger here in the French capital at plans for these kiosks to be replaced with something that is deemed to be more modern and more practical. Heritage groups are up in arms at the plans, and they accuse the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, of vandalism for even suggesting the change. Indeed, some unflattering comparisons have been made to the new design for this generation of kiosk, with some likening it to a recycling bin, others a photocopying machine, or a sardine can. Tens of thousands of Parisians have now signed a petition to save the old, much-loved kiosks, which millions of people walk past every day, and which remain the place where about half of all the city's newspapers are sold. But the kiosquiers, who for years have been struggling in the face of declining magazine and newspaper sales, do not seem quite so opposed to the new design, which will better protect newspapers and magazines from the elements, and which will be equipped with heating for the cold winter months. As well as being a more comfortable place to work, the new kiosk will also allow vendors to further diversify their product offering. For years now, practical items such as drinks, sweets, tissues and umbrellas have also been sold at Paris kiosks, and the idea seems to be to develop this new convenience store position in the market. After all, there are very few such mini-markets in the central Paris area. The consumer too stands to benefit. The new look kiosk will have a built-in refrigeration unit for cold drinks, a coffee machine, a letterbox and interactive screens on the outside, which will make some of these kiosk services automated and therefore available 24/7. They will also be illuminated in either green or red, indicating from afar whether or not they are open for business. The plan is that these new kiosks will be progressively rolled out until the summer of 2019, by which time all the previous models will have been replaced. Until Parisians get used to this new generation of kiosk, the comparisons with the 1857 design will inevitably continue. Where is the attractive metal dome? Where is the ornate frieze? People will continue to ask. But the choice seems to be this. It's either a new type of kiosk come convenience store, or no kiosk at all. But isn't there a third choice? A kiosk with all the mod cons offered by the new look design, and a business model which is more financially viable, but a kiosk that looks a little bit more like it belongs on the streets of this elegant city. I would have thought so. For Monocle, in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
Thank you, Tom. And that's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and to our editor, Toby Hammond. Comments or queries are welcome, of course. Drop us a note and do join us again at the same time next Saturday. You can always delve into the archive or listen again and find out more at monocle.com, iTunes, or your preferred platform. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.